Today is Monday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, is President Trump's relationship with Russia helping or hurting the United States? The debate over migrants entering Britain heats up as the number of new arrivals spikes. And a new film starring Clint Eastwood has the Hollywood star showing a softer, more vulnerable side. It's all on today's International Edition. Over the weekend, there were two explosive stories about President Donald Trump and his relationship with Russia. Joining me to help us better understand the developments is VOA's White House correspondent, Steve Herman. Steve, let's begin with the New York Times reporting the FBI began a counterintelligence investigation into Mr. Trump nearly 2 years ago after he fired former FBI Director James Comey. Explain the story, and what is the reaction from the White House?
Well, the newspaper was reporting that after the president fired Comey in 2017, that the FBI opened an investigation into whether the president was essentially working for the Russians. Now, it's not unusual for the FBI to do counterintelligence investigations about all sorts of things. That's their job, to figure out when foreign countries are doing something that they should not be doing in the United States. And, of course, what we do know is the special counsel has been looking into these connections between the Trump campaign in 2016 and Russia. And there's obviously been some evidence of that because we've had some guilty pleas from people that were involved in that campaign. But the question is really is to what extent was the president directly involved in all of this? And as some commentators are saying, because the president has repeatedly said there was no collusion between his campaign or between him and Russia, is essentially now that his actions as president that could be seen as obstruction, and that could be the collusion.
One of his actions was reported in the Washington Post over the weekend, and that is Mr. Trump prevented notes from his private meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin from being shared with his staff. Now, why is this significant?
Well, I was in Helsinki when this meeting occurred between the two presidents, and what was highly unusual about that was there was essentially nobody else in the room except for the translators. Usually when presidents meet like this one-on-one, there are note takers and maybe members of their cabinet, but usually perhaps those from the National Security Council or other White House staff. So that was certainly highly unusual. But what the Washington Post newspaper report is saying is that the president then demanded the notes that his interpreter had taken and told the interpreter not to share what had been said with anybody else. And it looks like that we will have perhaps that interpreter called before Congress now that the Democrats are in control of the House to testify about what that interpreter had heard at this meeting, something else that would just really be unprecedented.
Well, let's move from Russia to Syria now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been visiting key allies over the last week to discuss the U.S. policy in Syria. Now, yesterday, Mr. Trump issued a strong warning to Turkey regarding Syria. Tell us about that.
Yes, basically, we've had both the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, trying to reassure allies and Turkey that essentially the United States is just not suddenly going to pull the plug on its presence in Syria. This all goes back to a phone call that President Trump had with his Turkish counterpart when apparently the U.S. president became exasperated and essentially said, well, I'm just going to get out and turn this whole mess over to you. As you know, Jim, the Syria situation is really complicated. There's a lot of different players in there. It's not, in a sense, any sort of, you know, binary situation where there's one good guy and one bad guy. There's been concern, obviously, that if the United States were to suddenly pull out, that would give a green light for Turkey to go after the Kurds in Syria. And although Turkey regards some of these Syrian forces as terrorist groups, the Kurds have been allies of the United States in the fight against the Islamic State group. So a real complicated situation. And then we had this new tweet from the president, where he warned Turkey that there would be economic sanctions if they went after the Kurds. He also talked about some sort of safe zone in Turkey without elaborating. Again, is it going to be American troops that are policing the safe zone? We don't know about that. And then he also said that the United States would continue the fight in Syria against Islamic State from bases outside of Syria. So again, conflicting messages there, still a bit confusing, and we'll probably hear more from the president and members of his administration about this in the days ahead.
Well, Steve, there's so much to talk about. We could spend an hour just trying to explain all the pieces of Syria, but we're going to
write a book about it.
Yes, that's for sure. We're going to have to wrap things up there, unfortunately. Steve Herman, White House correspondent for VOA, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jim.
And this is International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman agreed Monday on the need to continue de-escalation in the conflict in Yemen. A Chinese court has sentenced a Canadian man to death on drug trafficking charges after his previous 15-year sentence was determined to be too lenient. A Taliban official tells VOA the Afghan peace talks with the U.S. are stalled. And a Kenyan court says three men must stand trial for their alleged role in the 2013 terrorist attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And VOA's International Edition continues. President Trump's plan to withdraw troops from Syria is underway, as Steve mentioned, with the Pentagon confirming equipment has begun leaving the battlefield, but soldiers are staying for now. With the American military present in 150 countries, fighting wars in seven, including Syria, President Trump is finding it difficult to fulfill his pledge to cut back on foreign military interventions. When Donald Trump won the White House, he outlined a military policy that avoids foreign intervention, putting a stop to what he calls never-ending wars.
This destructive cycle of intervention and chaos must finally, folks, come to an end.
Although President Trump pledged less military engagement, he has not cut defense spending. The U.S. remains the world's biggest military spender, accounting for 35% of global expenditures. Nan Tien is from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute.
U.S. military spending has remained constant for the second consecutive year.
The president's Syria troop withdrawal announcement has been criticized as hasty and ill-planned, but his broader vision to limit foreign military missions is supported by some on the left, including Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren. Some say President Trump's philosophy also echoes former President Obama's approach.
The Trump administration is now looking for a new conflict or a new war, which is the other theme that binds them together. Not only do we not want new wars, we want to take ourselves out of old wars.
But sometimes leaving can lead to more problems. American politicians are still grappling with lessons from U.S. interventions in Afghanistan, where American troops have been fighting since 2001, the longest war in U.S. history. In Syria, the war is even more complex, with adversaries that include the Islamic State, Iran, and Russia. Seth Jones is from the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Out is not a viable option because that means ceding everything to all of those entities.
Even as the U.S. began withdrawing equipment from the battlefield, analysts urged coordination towards finding a political settlement.
The U.S. has got to reset what its position and strategy is, and to make that clear and to negotiate that before making any public announcements.
This week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo continues a nine-nation tour of the Middle East, working to reassure allies worried about the shifting U.S. position. Well, Ebola is a major problem in parts of Congo right now. But as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, health workers may soon be able to cure those with the disease.
After years of effort, an international team of scientists has developed a treatment that can cure the Zaire strain of Ebola that's circulating in Congo and two other deadly strains of the virus. What's more, the treatment requires only a single injection. Thomas Geisbert spoke to VOA in a Skype interview from Houston, where he worked on this project in his laboratory at the University of Texas Medical Branch.
You know, when an outbreak first happens, we don't know which strain caused that outbreak until cases start coming in and you start having people. At that point, you're going to have deaths. You know, you're going to have people already dying, people very ill. And, you know, once you know what that strain is, yes, you can have one bug, one drug, you know, and if you have those countermeasures available. The disadvantage of that is that, again, these drugs are extremely expensive to make.
With the universal treatment, time isn't lost determining which strain of the virus is circulating, and people can be treated immediately. Plus, countries where Ebola is likely to break out can have a stockpile of the drug available. The treatment is a cocktail that cured monkeys that were infected with different strains of the virus. While nothing is 100% certain in science, Geisbert said research shows that this particular treatment is promising. The goals now are to see if the dose can be lowered and still be effective. This would lower the price, and to start clinical trials to make sure the treatment is safe and effective in humans. In addition to the University of Texas Medical Branch, scientists at MAP Biopharmaceutical, the U.S. Army Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, and the Public Health Agency of Canada also participated in the research. The treatment may not be ready to help those with Ebola in Congo, but the promise is that countries affected by the virus could have the treatment at the ready to stop future Ebola outbreaks. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
For more on this story, check out the VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hit makers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the past month, there's been a sharp increase in the number of migrants trying to cross the 30-kilometer English Channel from France to England. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the influx and the government's response is playing into a nervous political atmosphere over migration in Britain.
The naval vessels were pulled back from a joint European Union mission in the Mediterranean and are now patrolling the seas between Britain and France. Visiting the port of Dover recently, Home Secretary Sajid Javid questioned the motivation of those seeking asylum in Britain.
If you are a genuine asylum seeker, then why have you not sought asylum in the first safe country that you arrived in? because you know, you've taken France is not a country where anyone would argue is not safe.
The government says over 400 migrants have attempted to cross the English Channel from France in the last 3 months, often in inflatable dinghies in the middle of winter. Most appear to be from Iran. It is a journey fraught with danger across one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, with strong tides and currents. But while the political focus has been on the migrants coming across by boat, most arrive by air, while others try to hide underneath or inside trucks heading to Britain. Experts say increased security in French ferry ports could be driving migrants to attempt the sea crossing. Nour al-Hadi, or Yakhel, fled the Taliban in his native Afghanistan and came to Britain inside a refrigerated truck 3 years ago, aged just 16.
When it starts and he started the fridge, that was too cold. Like, we were just like hugging each other and sit in the middle of the lorry. When he opened the door, we just run away and jump off the lorry. So after we were walking on the motorway, like finally we come to the motorway and police catch us.
Oyakhel gained asylum in Britain, aided by the charity Kent Refugee Action Network. The organisation's Bridget Chapman says the government's reaction to the influx is driven by politics.
It's a crisis in that people are being forced to put their lives at risk to make a claim for asylum. That's completely unacceptable. But I think we're talking about roughly 250 people over 2.5 months. That isn't a crisis. Amongst certain people in power, there's a lot of juggling to see who can be the toughest on migration, because I think they see there may be a chance for a leadership bid. And that, to me, is playing politics with people's lives.
The government denies such accusations and says the deployment of naval vessels is needed to deter people smugglers and migrants from making such a dangerous journey. Others warn the naval ships could persuade more migrants to attempt the journey in the hope they will be rescued. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Folkestone on the south coast of Britain.
Heading halfway around the world, residents of the island of Hawaii are still assessing damage from the eruption of the Kilauea volcano 8 months ago, as VOA's Genia Dulant learned on a visit to the Big Island.
May's eruption was Kilauea's 62nd volcanic event in 36 years. One of five active volcanoes on the island of Hawaii, scientists believe Kilauea is dormant again following this latest eruption. The blast in May caused 825 million cubic meters of earth to collapse at the summit crater, sending magma gushing into underground tunnels. Lava flows emerged nearly 20 kilometers away, destroying 700 homes and forcing the evacuation of some 2,000 people. Among them, Herschel Hood, who has lived on the island for 13 years.
It was just a little piece of paradise right there. And it was so nice because it was about 3 miles from the ocean. So I could just drive my bicycle down the road and there was this beautiful ocean. And we had a beautiful organic farm. I mean, I had everything from dragon fruit to citrus trees, five different types of bananas. Everything just grows so good because of our beautiful rain and our beautiful sunshine and our volcanic soil.
After he evacuated, the continuing eruption caused a crack to open up in his backyard. All Hood has left is what he fled with, two cars and duffel bags with clothes and some documents. Now that the three-month-long eruption is over, he needs to rebuild his life. Like other eruption victims, he has received some financial help from the U.S. government, though not enough, he says, to build a new house. Tim Lloyd lived a few kilometers away from Hood. The molten lava did not reach his home, but it essentially cut it off from the rest of the island. Until a new road is built, he cannot move back.
We live on a volcano on an island, and it's active, and it's my perspective, it's part of living here. We have to deal with that, and we know that, but we don't really acknowledge it until it happens. It's impermanent here. Even though I think it's solid, it's not.
But despite the destruction, residents don't want to leave the Big Island. For some Hawaiians, every volcano eruption is an act of God. The goddess Pele, who was worshipped in traditional times, is the creator of the Hawaiian Islands. After all, new lava from every eruption expands the island's shores. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Island of Hawaii.
And this is VOA's International Edition. For over 50 years, Oscar-winning filmmaker and actor Clint Eastwood has portrayed tough characters, bounty hunters, police detectives, and macho heartthrobs. In his latest movie, The Mule, the octogenarian now softens his masculine persona to interpret a frail old man whose financial hardship forces him to take up a job as a drug courier, a mule for a Mexican drug cartel. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
Oh. Need help, sir?
Oh, officer, hi.
You need help?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
What do you got there?
Pecans. I'm delivering pecans to my niece.
Pecans? Here.
Yeah, pecans. She makes the worst pecan pie you've ever tasted.
No cop would suspect that Earl Stone is trafficking drugs. An old, upright, white man, Stone is above suspicion. But despite his quiet demeanor, Stone is resilient and the cartel's top mule, transporting millions of dollars worth of cocaine. A seasoned traveler who spent his career driving around the country as a horticulturalist, he knows how to navigate the American road system. He is never stopped for traffic violations and operates under the DEA agents' noses, even when he crosses paths with top agent Colin Bates, bent on capturing the elusive mule no one has ever seen, but everyone is talking about.
You got to think about family.
Yeah.
Anniversary is important. But you know, I'm the king of missing anniversaries. That's the problem, yes.
That's the first one I've missed. So.
Good luck. Don't follow my footsteps and do what I did. I put work in front of family. And this is the most important thing.
Bradley Cooper plays Officer Bates. He describes Eastwood's character.
It's a man on a path, reckoning his past, reckoning for his making up for mistakes, making peace with himself. But it's a reckoning for how he's lived his life.
Stone's financial troubles and his desire to make up for past mistakes and lost chances with his estranged wife and daughter lies at the heart of the story. Broke and rejected by his family, he takes a job as a drug mule, not out of greed, at least in the beginning, but out of despair to make things right. And though that is part of the film narrative, in some way, it reflects Eastwood's real life. Iris, his estranged on-screen daughter, is played by his real daughter, Allison Eastwood, who says she did not always have the best relationship with her dad.
It's been challenging because I do have such a great relationship with my dad these days, so I've had to sort of go back and dig around in the past of when I might have not been so happy with him and bring that up as an actor. You know, because this character is really angry.
As Stone makes up for lost time with his family, he's running out of time with the law. DEA agents are on his trail, and the cartel tightens its control over him, even as he is determined to keep his own timetable on the road. His illicit income is becoming more and more visible as he spreads money around.
He almost becomes like a Robin Hood character because he makes all this money unlawfully. But he goes around and starts helping people that need things.
But despite Eastwood's romantic spin on his stint as a drug mule, critics say the film glosses over the criminality of drug trafficking and the devastating effects of drugs and drug cartels on society. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. My thanks to our studio team, Director Patrice Martin, Engineer John Dryden. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for joining us.